Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're also pleased to have here on the program Dr. Suzanne Truppen. She is an obstetrician and a gynecologist. She is on the faculty of the U of I Med School here in Urbana-Champaign. She also has a practice in our area and for some time now has been stopping by. Once a month on a Monday, we talk about women's health. And she comes prepared to talk about a few things that may be new or she just thinks that you would be interested in learning about. But also the idea is that if you have questions, you can call and talk with her. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, 333-9455. And we do also have a toll-free line. That one's good anywhere that you can hear us around Illinois and Indiana. That's 800-222-9455. So at any point here, if you have questions about anything that she might happen to discuss or anything else, as long as it's within her area of practice, I know that she'll do her best to give you an answer and maybe add to your store of health knowledge. That's really the reason that we do these programs. Again, 333-9455 and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Welcome back.
Thank you. Good morning.
What would you like to talk about here?
Well, I thought I would talk a little bit about the subject of bone health and osteopenia and osteoporosis, but from the perspective of whether a woman is actually at risk for a fracture. One thing we've realized early on is that women who have bone density measurements that are low are candidates for therapy because they are, in fact, at risk for fractures. And there is a correlation between your actual bone density score, and we've talked about this a little bit before, and we usually talk about the T score in osteoporotic women and the Z score in T-score in women over the age of menopause or getting close to the age of menopause, I should correct myself and say, or the Z-score for younger women. And we define the T-score as a comparison of that bone thickness with a young, healthy adult. But since that T-score has only really been studied in menopausal age individuals, we can't really apply that to younger individuals, and we have to use a Z-score, just comparing them statistically to other people their age. And it turns out that if we use the World Health Organization definition of osteoporosis, which is a T-score less than or equal to minus 2.5, that we do capture many women who both would benefit from treatment and who are at risk for fracture, but we don't actually capture everybody who will ultimately have an osteoporotic fracture. And we need to do a better job of pinning down exactly what an individual's risk for fracture is as we get her tested. Mm-hmm. I know this tends to be kind of a complicated subject. So I wanted to talk a little bit about the 10-year probability of fracturing depending on your age and your score. And this gets very, very complicated pretty quickly. But basically, if you are a completely average score and you're 50 years old, you have about a 3.8 risk of fracture out of the next 10 years. So that's actually a fairly significant percent of the population. But if you are already testing positive range for osteoporosis and you're only 50 years old, in other words, that minus 2.5 score, you have about a 11% rate of fracture over the next 10 years. So you have a triple your rate of fracture. And if you compare that to somebody who's age 60, she has, if her score is only minus 2.0, so not formally yet even in the definition of osteoporosis by the World Health Organization, her rate of fracture over the next 10 years is about 12%. And if you look at a 65-year-old and with a score of minus 1.5 or less, she would probably be given the diagnosis of osteopenia according to the World Health Organization, but her fracture risk is also 12.5 over the next 10 years. And if you look at scores that are even higher than that, the numbers go up significantly. So that the point we want to convey to women is that, one, if you're if you're young and fairly healthy, your fracture risk, even with very poor scores, may not be significant in the short run. But number two, as we get older, even if your numbers are fairly reasonable, you actually have a fracture risk that may be significant and could potentially be very much lowered by medical therapy.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I'm sure that this is also something we've talked about over time, and that is when it is recommended that women have these kind of screening tests just to kind of see where they are with their bones, and in fact, how many women do actually have these tests and even have any idea where they fall?
Well, we still are falling short of national goals for screening patients, and what the goal should be varies between organization and organization, and there's been a lot of controversy about that. Different insurance companies have different criteria for when to screen, and what we have found out now, for instance, in women who have been on Depo-Provera for more than 2 years, they may in fact be losing some bone mass. So perhaps before continuing on their Depo-Provera, they may need to be screened. So that most physicians now are saying, yes, everybody over the age of 65 certainly should be screened, and men over 70. But if you have risk factors, then earlier ages of screening is very important. And those risk factors may be anything from medication use that would predispose you to bone loss, and steroids and Depo-Provera in that category, family history of osteoporosis, personal history of a fracture, personal history of smoking, low estrogen status, such as someone who's had stretches without periods. So we use men, and there are other factors as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And so then we have a couple callers here. I want to get to them. But in terms of the most basic sort of thing that people can do to make sure that they have strong bones, and it's something I guess we really all ought to be thinking about almost no matter what age you are, is make sure that you're getting adequate calcium. Get your calcium, get your vitamin D, have some weight-bearing exercise.
Right.
Is that about for both men and women? Is that
and
about
those
it?
Are very important. And because I do so much research in this area, we do a lot of vitamin D testing in potential research subjects. And it's been shocking. I think I discussed this, a report that had come out in the American Journal of the American Medical Association, that many individuals that live in the north have actually substandard levels of vitamin D. And I didn't believe it until I had seen so many of my research subjects get excluded because of their extraordinarily low vitamin D levels, shockingly low in people who thought they were getting adequate vitamin D and calcium. So that's that's a new crusade of mine, that even if you think you're getting enough vitamin D, you do need to talk to your healthcare provider about what your intake is. And in cases where people are testing with lower than normal bone mass, start thinking about getting a calcium and vitamin D blood test to see if, in fact, your nutrition is where you think it should be.
Okay. Our guest this morning, Dr. Suzanne Troopen. She is an obstetrician and gynecologist. She's on the program once a month, always a Monday. We talk about women's health. We have two callers here ready and waiting. The number, if you'd like to call in and ask a question, the number is 333-9455. Now, that's the number for Champaign-Urbana. We do also have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. First caller up is in Indiana on line number 4. Hello.
Hello. Mm-hmm. I've been listening to the doctor for years now, and being a male, I've never asked a question, but it's finally gotten to me. Everything being equal, why is it that the women lose the bone density quicker or faster or whatever the parameters are than men? My doctor's never said anything to me about, you know, checking my bone density. And I know in the last few years there have been a lot of new tests and experiments which show that women, you know, heretofore thought before were, you know, didn't do things like men do. And all of a sudden things are starting to occur that they do die of heart attack in certain groups, you know, more than men. I'm just wondering what the scientific evidence is.
Well, specifically with the bone question is, one, size does protect to some extent. So most men are physically bigger. They have, therefore, more bone mass. They're carrying more weight on their bone, and that is a stimulus for their bones to stay denser. But probably even a bigger contributing factor is the fact that men continue their testosterone production fairly normally in as they age into their 60s and 70s and often even into their early 80s, whereas women have that radical reduction in their estrogen production and fairly rapid decline in their own small levels of testosterone. So we think that this menopausal osteoporosis is a little dip in bone density specifically for women. But you're absolutely right. This is an area of medicine where doctors just aren't thinking that it can happen to men, but men over 70 should be tested and men with risk factors younger than that.
How often should, say, a lady that's 50, a tad over 50 now should be checked?
I think that women over 50 should be checked. And it's probably one of those areas of medicine where she needs to talk to her own health care provider, check with her insurance company. If she doesn't have insurance coverage, there are lots of health fairs which will screen your wrist, your heel, or your finger, which may not be as accurate as your spine and your hip, but at least it's a start if somebody didn't have coverage.
Thanks a lot.
All right, thank you. And the kind of test you're talking about is non-invasive. It just means
it's the next,
sort of sticking.
There are two types. There's one type on the heel that's actually an ultrasound, but all the other tests are actually x-ray. But they estimate that even the technologist standing next to the table running those exams all day long, every day of her working career, will only get the extra UV radiation that she would get if she spent one extra day outside. So they are x-ray, but they've modified these machines so intensely that the x-ray exposure is a fraction.
Okay. And that, though, is there a question about whether they are, well, how accurate they are?
There seems to be about a 1% error rate. And when we, I'm certified by the International Society of Clinical Densitometry, and they go to great lengths to teach you how to do the formulas. And we scan a block on a daily basis, and we calibrate our machine with 30 scans, and we calculate what our precision error is, and then we calculate when you get, it's not so important for the first test, it's important, but it's more important for subsequent follow-up tests for the radiologist to, number one, compare your first test to your second test, again, more accurate if you were done on the same machine, but there are actual formulas that you can use to calibrate the different machines against each other. And then you want to find out if your change exceeds their least significant error. And so sometimes there are slight variations in your numbers that aren't clinically significant. That's a long way of saying that don't get your test done too soon. It is possible to repeat a test after treatment in 6 months and see some positive, but I encourage most of my patients to wait 1 to 2 years just so that we get away from the error rate of that machine.
All right. We have some other callers, two. They're both in Urbana. Next is line one. Hello.
Hi. I can't find the article right now because we just cleaned up for company. But it was either Consumer Reports on Health or the Center for Science and the Public Interest newsletter called Nutrition Action. And it was about, lead stored in our bones. And it makes the point that although we've done a lot to reduce environmental lead so that younger people are not storing, not being exposed and storing much lead in their bones, that a lot of us who are older do have lead in our bones. And when we lose calcium from the bones, lead also comes out. And there was a whole list of things that lead, nasty things that lead does, one of which was cognitive decline. And I hadn't thought about this or seen anything about it before as another consequence of not having strong bones. If you can keep your bones from losing calcium, you're probably also going to keep it from leaching out lead. And I was also, my hubby had had some blood tests in advance of a surgical procedure, and he had low blood calcium. And I said to him, you know, you're not getting enough calcium. He doesn't like to drink milk. It seems to me, I read somewhere, and I really should look this up, but it seems to me that calcium does a lot of things in our body in addition to keeping our bones strong, and our bones are kind of act as the reservoir for them. Can you tell me offhand whether it seems to me calcium is also responsible for heart health? Is that correct?
Well, calcium, absolutely right, is one of the most important substances that we have, and it is important for muscular activity, and a very important muscle in our body is the heart. And poor calcium levels can lead to heart issues. But that is why the bones are designed to be able to quickly, the bones are our reservoir, you're absolutely right, and we are designed such that we put calcium down into the reservoir, but that process is slow on purpose, because you don't want that to be a big vacuum cleaner of the calcium out of your bloodstream into your bones, but it's also designed to quickly release the calcium from the bone, so that if indeed you had inadequate intake on a particular short-term basis, that your bones could more quickly release. So what we think happens as we get older, and when women, and we don't know all the factors. In fact, there are dozens of hormones that actually control this process. So if a true physiologist is listening, we're greatly oversimplifying all this. But one of the things that happens is this uncoupling, so that our wearing away is still at a fairly normal and rapid process, but our deposition is more slow. And one thing that we do with all the treatments that we currently have available, except for one, is that we slow down this wearing away. Again, this becomes now a question. What is too slow? And is too slow a potential problem? And in fact, too slow is a potential problem as well. But we only have the parathyroid hormone treatment that actually increases how much you actually put down, and doesn't improve the score and improve fracture prevention by decreasing this wearing away. And yet it's such a expensive and difficult to administer and a potential problem for very long-term use, that it's only recommended in certain circumstances and with very careful supervision, and probably not more than 2 years for most people. So for most of us, there's still going to be other strategies that we're going to need probably as we get older. But I hadn't heard your point about lead. I'll have to read that myself. It does make some sense. And I know that when patients have asked me about specific sources of calcium, one popular way used to be to grind up horse bone and get calcium that way. And it was thought it was fairly natural. It was a natural product. But in fact, leads, mercury, and other significant metals that are very potentially harmful were found to be possibly contained in those types of products. So this is one scenario where synthetic is safer, because you avoid all that.
Well, we also used to have lead in gasoline, for instance. So we were all breathing it, and it was in the dust around.
Sure.
And lead in paints. And so forth. So at least we're working in the right direction for future generations. But I just thought it was interesting about the cognitive decline, and
that is interesting. And I'll have to read those articles and see to what level of significance and how much this is a hypothesis and how much this has been confirmed.
Yeah,
because I didn't get a chance to read those.
Well, there are several other reasons not to keep. There's several other bad things that lead does. That was just the one that I can tell you right now.
Sure.
Thanks a bunch.
All right, let's talk with somebody else here. This is also an Urbana caller, line number two. Hello.
Yes, I would like to add to your list of calcium, vitamin D, and exercise as developing and maintaining bone health. And two things. One is posture, in particular, starting with adolescent girls. And the second thing is eating a normal protein intake, which in America generally is higher than the average. And that's just my comment, and I'd be interested in hearing anything you'd have to say about that.
Well, it is a good comment, and the protein intake story has been a very interesting one. For those listeners who haven't heard, it's thought that very high levels of protein could potentially decrease your bone health by increasing the amount of calcium that you secrete from your kidney every day. And they... the original hypothesis looked at societies with very high protein intake, and they also had high rates of osteopenia and osteoporosis bone loss. So the original information was strictly epidemiologic. And there have been a number of studies recently done scientifically in a prospective way trying to look at this and to confirm that levels of protein intake might in fact alter your calcium, what we call homeostasis, your levels, the stability of the calcium in your system and whether or not you secrete extra amounts of calcium during the day and so forth and so on. And what I'm thinking is, and I can't quote you the source because I haven't read it recently, but I'm thinking that the most recent information was disproving this protein hypothesis. And I still believe that many of us have too high a protein intake and that the jury may still be out specifically with respect to this calcium and protein. And I know that it's still being studied. So you're absolutely right. If I was giving somebody nutritional advice, I caution about that. I know there's a lot of the people then back that up with, okay, aha, you know, what about Atkins? What about South Beach? Most of the studies indicate that people don't stay on them that tightly for that long of a time that it should make a difference. But maybe a young person really strongly adhering to that kind of diet for years and years and years may have other issues, and maybe that person needs to be supplemented with calcium. So I haven't, you may want to check, get to a medical library, get to a public library, or get on the internet and see what the latest information is about that protein, because I think the most recent studies haven't confirmed that. In terms of posture, there's no doubt about it that posture is extremely important for our health. And in terms of adolescence, there are a couple of issues. One is they may have an imbalance of their muscle groups, so that, for instance, in some swimmers, my family, we all swim, so I pay a lot of attention to this. You may build up your back muscles over some of the counterbalancing muscles in the front of your body, and that may predispose you to sort of a hunched shoulder look. So merely by paying attention to what muscle groups you're building up, that can also help your posture, as well as just, you know, the way your mom points to you in the middle of your back and says, stand up. Also, in my older population of patients, I noticed there's just a natural slumping, and therefore any fracturing and any kyphosis, that dorsal hump that develops, can be slightly improved by better posture. But I don't know of any direct evidence that posture itself can improve your bones, unless I'm missing
something.
Wouldn't
posture be an anti-gravity effect, such as exercise? Because if you're hunching all the time, there's no anti-gravity effect, which maintains the bone health. So when you're standing erect,
I would have to defer to the literature on that. I'm not sure that the slight difference in your erect state versus a hunch state would really have enough difference in gravity. The other factor is that we're getting so much heavier. There was a recent calculation that in the past 30 years, individuals in their 60s, 70s, 80s are maybe about an inch taller than we used to be, but the amount of weight that we've gained is much greater. And so particularly in the young and adolescent population, the incidence of being overweight is much higher, and actually physically being overweight makes your bones work harder. And that's a little bit of a stimulus to increase the calcium in your bones. So I think, unfortunately, it's such a complicated topic with, like you say, you know, all these extra little factors, that it takes a lot of attention to an individual's overall health to come up with the right solution for each person.
Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Our guest this morning on Focus 580 is Dr. Suzanne Truppen. She is an obstetrician and gynecologist. She has practice here in our area. She teaches at U of I Med School. And once a month, on a Monday, she stops by here. We talk about women's health. We're at the midpoint here, so we certainly have time for other questions. 333-9455 in Champaign-Urbana, toll-free 800-222-9455.
I was just going to say that we may be seeing new medications for the treatment of osteoporosis that are coming on the market. Many individuals have in the past been treated with estrogen therapy, and it's currently thought that if somebody is strictly treating osteopenia and osteoporosis or trying to prevent that, that perhaps they should think about the alternative medications, including the SERMs, which are Vista, and including the bisphosphonates. Bisphosphonates, the number one side effects tend to be GI, stomach upset, heartburn kinds of indigestion feelings. And those side effects are dramatically minimized with correct way of taking the medicine. But there are several bisphosphonates that are being evaluated that are going to be available intravenously. And we're testing some of those. And the big advantage of that is that you don't have to swallow. So the, mm-hmm. the GI side effects that come directly from having that medication in the GI tract should basically be eliminated.
And are these now medications, do these more than prevent more bone loss? Can they actually rebuild, or do they just hold you
If you do research studies, you will see that a certain relatively smaller percentage of the population will actually gain bone density, so they will add some mass. A significant percentage stay the same, and some lose, but they lose slower than they would lose off the medication. And what's most important is being on medication prevents fractures, no matter which group you're in. So even if you're in the group that's actually losing bone mass still, if you're on medication, you're less likely to fracture. And the whole goal is to prevent fractures. Now, I'm going to have to read that lead study, because one goal wasn't necessarily to prevent things like lead from leaching out of your bones. I'll have to think about that. But we do like to slow down bone turnover. And even though I think our caller asked, how often do you get repeat tests? But I think that another thing to consider, or I guess you were asking me the accuracy, and we were talking about getting repeat testing, but also you can use these urine tests that are markers of your bone turnover to decide whether or not you're having effective therapy from your prescription medication.
Right. Now we have someone else to talk with, someone in Hidalgo on our line number 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yeah.
What would cause a person to have too much calcium deposited around his spinal cord? Because you'd have to have, I had it around my back, and then I had to have it chiseled out. That made me have lots of problems. What would cause you to have all that calcium buildup around your spinal cord?
Well, once you get a diagnosis like that, it's always important to talk to your healthcare provider and see if they can, as much as giving you a current diagnosis, if they can give you some insight as to how you got that way and how you might prevent being that way in the future. I know that some of those calcium deposits are strictly from arthritis. And unfortunately, knowing the causes of arthritis is a lot more complicated. We think that some may be immune-based. We think that some may be trauma-based, and there may be other factors as well. It starts to get beyond my direct area of knowledge. But probably arthritis is the number one cause that has those calcium deposits. But I think it's a relatively rare individual that then has to have actual removal of those deposits.
What, is that because they just went to the wrong place? Didn't go into your bone mass, or didn't have good use of it?
Yeah, I don't know. It's a good theory, but I'm not sure about that.
Yeah.
Interesting theory, I should say.
Well, I had back surgery, and and I had my calcium deposit was around my spinal cord so bad that they had to, you know, get it out, and it left me kind of in bad shape. That's the reason I wondered.
Yeah.
I had it in my lower back and then my neck, but of course I had some injuries, and maybe that was the cause of it.
Yeah. Traumatic calcium deposits are fairly common.
Yeah. Okay.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. Then I guess that maybe leads to a question. Is it actually possible to get too much calcium? Should one be careful that you don't?
I've backed off on those suggestions a lot. We used to think that too much calcium could increase your risk for kidney stones. Yeah. And then there was a study that denied that. So I think there probably are limits, but I think most patients aren't really coming close to those limits.
All right. So probably if a person is at not going much over what is the recommended daily amount,
correct,
then probably that should be
right.
Okay.
But what I find is some people look up the recommended daily amount and then they try to get that full amount in their supplements without thinking about their diet. And we have to remember that even if you aren't eating dairy products, nuts are high in calcium. Even a potato might have 60 milligrams of calcium. So you do need to think a little bit about what's actually in your food.
Mm-hmm. Well, that raises one more question, and I get to the callers here. Supposing you decide that you want to supplement your calcium, and you decide that you need, 1,000 milligrams.
Sure.
So do you, if you had your choice between taking a pill with 1,000 milligrams and popping that pill, or taking 2 500s, or taking 4 250s, or you see what
right.
I mean, and taking it in little bits throughout the day.
There
or
are a couple things. First of all, if you need 1,000, you probably don't need to take a full 1,000 supplement. You're probably, even with a crummy diet, you're probably getting 500, at least on some days. There is some research about how much you should do, but to some extent, you've got to be a little bit practical. So it's much easier to get yourself to do one health behavior a day rather than four. So that's one issue. The other thing is that there are some big no-nos, like you don't want to chew your calcium pill and swig down a pop because the phosphorus in the carbonation will block your calcium absorption. There's some medications that you don't want to take at the same time as your calcium. But once you're not violating those kinds of things, probably aren't a lot of do's and don'ts. And a lot depends on what you like to do. Some people like to get the orange juice with the calcium supplementation. And some people like to get all their nutrition from food, which is a great strategy. But you have to exercise enough and be careful enough with your food intake that your calorie count doesn't go up too much, just trying to meet your vitamin requirements.
Mm-hmm. Okay. The next caller's in Charleston. Line one. Yes.
Good morning.
Yes.
I have a question for the doctor regarding a product called Miacalcin. I'm presently, taking that, and it's administered nasally, and I'm interested in knowing if where it stands in the spectrum of calcium supplements. And another question, a short one, is there any distinction, noticeable distinction between calcium carbonate and the calcium citrate, which is found in the products, the pill products? Thank you.
I was going to mention, I'm glad you brought up that point of the different types of calcium that are out there. And if you do studies and you look at very specific levels that people get in, probably the citrated calciums do a little bit better in terms of absorption. But for most people, anything you get is adequate. And I think that it's just important to get something. And a lot of the calcium carbonates are the least expensive products, which I like because I'm the goal is to get calcium in. In terms of the Miacalcin, it's a synthetic calcitonin. We first were only able to get that bone hormone from salmon, the fish, and it was very expensive and very hard to harvest, and it caused a lot of side effects, and it was a big breakthrough that the Miacalcin came out and was able to provide individuals with a product. It's kind of a a tough question to answer fairly simply. First of all, it's only approved for the treatment of osteoporosis. And I do see a number of individuals who have wound up on this medication for the treatment of osteopenia, or in other words, the prevention of osteoporosis. And it's really not something I typically personally prescribe for the prevention of osteoporosis, but I do see other physicians doing that. And I know that sometimes they're weighing the risks and benefits and side effects of some of the other medications. And physicians tend to come to their own conclusions, which they should, based on the information they evaluate. And it's just not a direction I go in a lot. Also, if you look at the studies done, there aren't as many studies done as particularly with the bisphosphonates. And in many of the studies, they weren't powered sufficiently enough to help answer the question of fracture prevention in certain parts of the body. And because of that lack of data on some of the other medications, we have better information about fracture prevention at certain sites. So that's another reason I tend towards some of the other medications. But it certainly is a medicine that has been approved for the treatment of osteoporosis. It has the ability to be taken nasally. So if you have a problem with reflux or gastric upset and couldn't take the bisphosphonates or weren't a candidate for estrogens and weren't a candidate for the SERMs, then it's a medication that we can look at if you go through all those other product categories.
My family had osteoporosis. In fact, my mother passed away a few years ago, and she definitely had it, and I do believe my grandmother had it. So this may have played a part in the physician's prescribing this.
Right. And as you get more thorough into your evaluation, knowing what your calcium level is, knowing what your vitamin D level, blood level is, knowing whether or not you have bone turnover, getting the bone density test to know what your T-score is,
yes,
and finally even having actual x-rays to determine your whether or not there are small fractures already developing, because not all bone density tests can actually read out fractures. And then even further than that, certain muscle strength evaluation and posture evaluation all can help evaluate bone health. You know, we tend to kind of whittle all those things down to what's your T-score, but there's really more to it than that.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. And again, I want to tell people listening that if you have questions, you'd like to join the conversation, you certainly can do that. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one's good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. We have a caller in McLean County next to talk with on the toll-free line right here.
Hello.
Yes.
I have a question, obviously, about what to do if I cannot handle Fosmax or Actonol because of my GI problems and cannot do the mycalcin because of allergies and nasal congestion. What other options do I have? And I'm sorry, I just turned the radio on, so if there are other options that you have mentioned, I've missed it, and it's been a problem for me because I have another order from Fosamax, and I haven't filled it, and I don't even know if I should really fill it because of the way my stomach's been for the last four or five weeks.
Well, those are very, very good questions, and of course, the thorough answer is to talk to your physician and find out what he or she might offer you. The quick answers in general, for any listeners who have had problems tolerating bisphosphonate, traditionally has been to look at either a SERM, a selective estrogen receptor modulator, and the only one currently on the market is Avista. There are other SERMs in testing and development. And the other option is hormone treatment with estrogen, which has its own set of risk factors. And in fact, there's a new patch that's been approved that's very, very tiny, very low dose of estrogen. And with the patch delivery system, it has less potential risks in certain studies. So those two things, there are at least two alternatives that you may not have explored quite yet.
Okay.
In the past, people used fluoride. We don't tend to use that anymore. There's also the treatment with parathyroid hormone. Again, I did talk about that very briefly, but it tends to be a more shorter-term kind of thing. And then finally, there are a lot of bisphosphonates in development. We're actually doing a study specifically looking for people that I didn't tell this person to call in, but we are doing a study looking for individuals who didn't tolerate their bisphosphonates to look at other delivery systems like injection delivery systems and other ways that other timing ways that you can take your medicine. So if it's anything that you're interested in, you can always call me at Women's Health Practice and we could talk to you about it. But there are many bisphosphonates undergoing testing, and there are a couple that are being tested for intravenous administration and even for individuals who may not have been ever tested and might want to consider these alternative medications. We have the ability to screen patients at no charge to them right now.
Could you give me that number, and if I can ask one more quick question?
Sure. The number's 217-356-3736.
3736. The last question is, if nothing works out, like if I can't do any of the other options like estrogen or Avista, what can a person do?
Well, calcium, vitamin D, and actually getting tested to make sure your vitamin D levels are adequate, exercise, and get tested to see what your bones are doing. And of course, there are always new things coming around all the time.
Okay, well, thank you very, very much. I'm
all
so glad you're on today.
Very good. Well,
thanks.
You. Another caller here. This is someone listening in Lawrenceville, Illinois, on our line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I just wanted to tell the doctor, I'm 72. I couldn't tolerate the Fosamax because it gave me bleeding ulcers. So I am on Myocalcin. I have osteopenia. I don't have osteoporosis, but my last bone density scan gave me a gain of 0.2. So I think it's a good thing.
Oh, absolutely. And you're absolutely right that once you don't tolerate a particular medication, there are other alternatives.
Mm-hmm.
And that's
it. I'm sorry.
Oh, but what
well,
we
you said something about not offering Myocalcin to people unless they have osteoporosis. I am not in the porosis stage, but...
Right.
But,
what I was quoting is that with that medication, in terms of what it is approved for by the FDA and what it's mostly been studied for, is mm-hmm. is the treatment of osteoporosis.
Mm-hmm.
And that that there may be theoretical reasons why individuals with either normal bone density but risk factors, or individuals with osteopenia as a diagnosis who perhaps can take the alternative medications, may in fact have extra benefit. But it's different once you have a set of clinical circumstances that doesn't allow you to take other medications, then it may be the best alternative for a particular individual.
Okay, because I just wanted to give you that little bit of news that it's helping me for sure. So, you know, it is, I know it's a fairly new, I don't know if it's new or not, but I know the studies aren't, you know, as extensive on it. But it's been a good thing for me. So thanks a lot. I enjoy listening to you.
Okay, very good. Thank you. And again, other questions, welcome. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. We have about probably 7-8 minutes left.
Well, and the other issue about osteoporosis and osteopenia treatment is how many years we should keep our patients on and whether or not they need drug holidays. And this is still being looked at. We do know that at least for the drugs Fosamax and Actonel, they have long-term data establishing that both long-term use can both be safe and effective at additional fracture prevention for up to 10 years. And now they're even looking at groups even longer than 10 years. But whether or not for overall health, this is going to be the best idea to keep somebody indefinitely on these medicines? That's a question we're still going to have to answer, and it may be a benefit to take certain medicines at a certain age and other medicines at other ages.
Okay. Well, again, if other people have questions, I think we have somebody else coming in here. You came prepared to talk about a number of things, and
I think did, and we didn't get on. I know we only got on one topic.
Well, that's it. Well, we got some other calls,
I'll try to answer them quickly.
Okay, we'll go to Southern LaSalle County, line 4, toll free line. Hello.
I just told somebody else that somebody in my family one time called me fast mouth, so I think it ought to work out. Anyway, I really would have what's generalized, I guess it's called neuropathy, peripheral neuropathy. But what I'm curious about, and I don't have this, but somebody said you better see the doctor if something starts turning black. Well, I know that might mean gangrene. So what do they do if you ever start having anything like that?
Well, this gets a little bit away from my particular field, but circulation is, of course, very, very important. And there are signs of low circulation prior to circulation completely getting cut off from a particular area.
Like bumps?
But, well, skin discoloration, skin irritations, tingling and numbness, those are symptoms. Poor function is a potential symptom as well. So anybody who has any signs of peripheral neuropathy should see their primary care.
And they're supposed to call me back. I would give advice to people going to Mayo's. I went right between Christmas and New Year's thinking it would be a great time. It's a great time to get registered, but months later to get the appointment. So anyway, I'll watch it. I'm keeping walking as long as I can.
Sounds good.
Thank you. You're very helpful.
Let's come back here to someone local, and this is line 1 in Urbana. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I know this isn't what doesn't have anything to do with osteoporosis, but I was wondering if Dr. Trupin would comment on what tests are appropriate to test for yeast overgrowth syndrome, or I don't know how to say it, candidiasis.
Well, that's a good question, and we don't really have an answer for it. There's a couple of different schools of thought. One school of thought is that minor localized candida infections of the mouth, of the vaginal area, or of the rectal area are extremely common and can be tested for by any of the commonly available culture or wet prep techniques that we have. But whether or not a young, healthy person or generally healthy person can get this infection disseminated such that it's in other parts of their bodies or even their bloodstream is a little bit of a controversial topic. We know that somebody with immune compromise, such as a diabetic or somebody with HIV disease, certainly could get candidiasis, but it would be extremely uncommon, if possible at all, for somebody younger and healthier. And that's probably the kind of thing that only a specialist in infectious disease would really be able to give advice about, the specialized tests that would be needed to test for generalized infection.
Well, if you were diagnosed with generalized infection but you didn't have any local infections, would that be contradictory?
It is supposed to be possible, but it isn't very likely, and your primary care physician would probably want to see what the basis of that diagnosis was. And I know that some people are treated what we call presumptively, even if the testing doesn't confirm what we were looking for. Sometimes it's worth, if somebody has symptoms that are close enough for long enough, it's worth treatment based on a presumptive diagnosis. But for something like that, probably an accurate diagnosis would be better.
Okay, thank you. Well, the treatment then is the antifungal medications and diet, right?
Yes.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right, thank you. We have maybe about a minute or so left. I don't know if there's something you can do that quick.
Well, I was going to talk a little bit about premature ovarian failure, and maybe it's something that I can talk about next time. We think that any woman under the age of 40 who goes more than 4 months with no period might, in fact, have premature failure of the ovary, and it's a diagnosis that we're making much more commonly. And in these women, they are also known to have other autoimmune problems, and they may, in fact, have problems with their thyroid gland or their adrenal gland or their pancreatic gland, so in other words, diabetes. And that if you go for more than 4 months and you're not on any special treatment like continuous birth control pills and you have not had a menstrual period, it is worth getting that period of amenorrhea, in other words, the lack of periods, checked by your primary women's health care provider.
Okay. Well, I thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.
I appreciate it. Dr. Suzanne Truppen, she's an obstetrician and gynecologist. She's on this program once a month, always on Monday. We talk about women's health.